'Tis but thy name that is my enemy. Thou art thyself, though not a Montague. What's Montague? It's not hand, nor foot, nor arm, nor face, nor any other part belonging to a man. Oh, be some other name. What's in a name? That which we call a rose, by any other name, would smell as sweet. So Romeo would, were he not Romeo called, retain that dear perfection which he owes without that title. Romeo, doff thy name, and for that name, which is no part of thee, take all myself. In this speech that Juliet speaks to Romeo, in Romeo and Juliet, she is lamenting the fact that Romeo's family name is somehow completely him, and yet not at all him. It's the name Montague that unequivocally sets him and his family at odds with her and her family, the Capulets. Who is against the Capulets? The Montagues. Who is a Montague? Romeo. And yet, no part of Romeo is actually against Juliet. He loves her. If only he would be known by a different name, he would still be the same Romeo that loved her, wouldn't he? And yet, he would still be of the family Montague. That name wouldn't actually change the reality of the situation. And names are really, really important. They can give us context into something. They can be descriptors. They can let us know someone or something's affiliation with another thing. They're both personal and informative at the exact same time. And this is partially why we always cringe just a little bit when someone gets our name wrong. Maybe they use an abbreviated form of your name and they're really just not that close. Like your name is Joseph and they just like, hey, Joe. You're like, don't do that. I don't like that. We don't have this relationship yet. Or maybe they use a longer form of your name when you're only known as the shorter form. Like if you go by Sam, they say, oh, hello, Samuel. You're like, only my mother says that when she's mad. Don't use that. Or maybe they know you really well and they just accidentally mess up your name, like Micah and Michael. That happens all the time. I'm not going to point any fingers, but it happens all the time. It has since I was a kid. Or maybe they're even making fun of your name in some way. Maybe they make a rhyme with it or just kind of poke fun at you a little bit by using your name in a joke. And sometimes this stuff is fine and it's done innocently or it's done in good fun. But it always, always catches our ear. So even if we're not offended by it, there's a certain place where you're just like, that, I was expecting to hear my name back to me and I didn't. Something was different there. Something was off. Sometimes our names that we love and hope are respected can be used in ways that aren't so good. Like the name is used correctly, but then the surrounding information or the surrounding context that it's used in isn't so good. In The Office, this happens when the show The Office from NBC, Andy is trying to get everyone to not like this guy, Dwight. And so he starts saying the phrase, he shrewded it, because Dwight's last name is Shrewd, to mean you messed something up. So it's like, oh yeah, you mess up that paperwork, you really shrewded it. He uses the guy's last name as a symbol of failure. Or what if someone just said, hey Micah, how are you? That'd be great, that'd be nice to hear. But what if someone said, oh, it's Micah. They used my name correctly, but something about that just didn't sit right. Throughout time, those who have believed like we do have been called a number of different things. Some have been really hard to take, and some have been worn as badges of honor in spite of the insult that they were meant to be. And so today I'd like to go over some of these insulting names and look at how the people throughout history that share our beliefs adopted those names proudly and showed how we might follow that example as we walk deeper and deeper into a time where our faith might also get called a series of nasty names. The first name I want to look at today, we're actually going to be following quite a lot through Paul's journeys, because although people in the Old Testament were certainly called different names by various people, in the New Testament we can look at those people and see that we share a certain similarity with them, right? this is after the death and resurrection of Christ. And this is a lot closer to our time period. And so people act in a much more familiar way. You've got Greek-minded people or Roman-minded people. And that's a lot more similar to how our landscape is today, as opposed to going back maybe to like ancient Israel and with a Hebrew or a Canaanite mindset. That's a lot more foreign to us. And it also lacks some of the fullness that our faith has now that we're aware of Jesus Christ and his death and his resurrection. So we're going to be following through a lot in the book of Acts today, because I think not only are we going to see a similarity between how people thought then, but also the kinds of names that they were called at this time. And the first name I want to look at is the name Nazarenes. Now, this doesn't sound very sinister. Nazarenes just comes from the idea that Jesus was from Nazareth. So what's so wrong with that? In our minds, someone called a Nazarene is just someone like, you know, relatively associated with Jesus of Nazareth. So what could be wrong about that? How many of you have ever heard of Bessemer, Alabama? Raise your hands. 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay. So very few of you in the whole, why have you not all heard of Bessemer, Alabama? Isn't that a household name? No, it's not. Bessemer, Alabama is one of the worst places to live in the world, according to like 50 different sites that rank worst cities to live in. Their crime rate is horrible. They are not a desirable place to live. Even the few people that do live there vote against it, like they actively don't like it. It's in decline. There's no new business. It's a declining economy. They used to be a coal town, an iron town. Now they just don't really do a lot, so a lot of rundown mines. They have a really small population, bad schools, and this is just the things that we know. These are just the statistics about it. But what is assumed about a place like this? It's even worse. People will go as far as to say, well, yeah, sure, I mean, it's dangerous. What if the crime rate only had to do with something like petty theft, right? You'd be like, well, that's not great, but that still counts in their crime rate. But what if nobody dies? We would still look at that place and say, wow, the crime rate is so high, it must be dangerous. And so it gets that name tacked on. Even though people might not die there, the assumption is, oh, Bessemer, Alabama, you don't want to go there. It's a dangerous place. They're probably inbred. They got poor hygiene. They're stupid. Those are the things that people might say about a place like this. When someone was calling a person a Nazarene, the person calling them this was trying to delegitimize the person by associating them with the place. So think of Nazareth as Bessemer, Alabama. Not only did it have all of these statistics about it, that it didn't have the greatest school system, it didn't have a lot of shops, didn't have new growth, didn't have a big population, didn't have a good economy, but then you have the mental picture that we place on a place like that, dangerous, stupid, insignificant, unimportant. This is Nazareth. And so when they did this, and they tried to delegitimize a person, what they were saying was, you're really going to listen to someone from Nazareth? The stupidest place you could ever imagine? The place that nobody wants to live at all? That's who you're going to listen to? Do I need any more proof that they're up to no good? They're associated with Nazareth. They're from nothing, from nowhere. And so this was a slight. And this gives a little bit of context to what happens in John 1:46 when Philip is talking with his friend Nathanael and he says, come and see, we have found the Messiah. And he's Jesus from Nazareth. And Nathanael says, can anything good come out of Nazareth? This isn't just asking, could something as good as the Messiah come out of a small place like that? That's sometimes how we read it. What Nathanael is asking here is, could anything good or remotely decent come out of a place like Nazareth, let alone the Savior of Israel? He's not asking, can this good thing come out? He's asking, can anything good come out of Nazareth? And so this is what they're doing when they're trying to call somebody a Nazarene. When Christians in the New Testament got this moniker, this is what was being said about them. Turn with me to Acts 24. We'll see a time where this was used. And we'll also see the response. Because I think that's the most important part. It's not so much that people would call names to people. It's what was the response of the Christians being called these names. We'll start reading in verse 1. This is after Paul is imprisoned, and he has been taken away to be tried. He's kind of been removed from a lot of the major chaos that he was in before. People were rising up against him. They wanted him put down immediately. And so some of the higher-ups took him away to Caesarea Maritime, and this is where they were going to try him. And so you have some really high-up people in the Jewish faith coming to witness against Paul. It says, and after 5 days, the high priest Ananias came down with some elders and a spokesman, one Tertullus. So the high priest himself comes down. That's not a small thing. Okay, he doesn't just leave his bedroom for anything, right? He's there because Paul is a threat. And so they're looking for any way to put this movement down. They even have a spokesman there. So this would be someone who was intelligent and good with speech and knew how to manipulate words and manipulate the thoughts of other people. And it says, they laid before the governor their case against Paul. And when he had been summoned, Tertullus began to accuse him, saying, since through you we enjoy much peace, and since by your foresight, most excellent Felix, reforms are being made for this nation, in every way and everywhere we accept this with all gratitude. So he's sucking up, right? Ah, Felix, what a wonderful job you've done with our nation. You govern so well. You're a genius. You protect us. We're healthy, wealthy, and wise, all because of you. Yeah, Felix is going to like this, right? He wants to hear all of this stuff. And then he goes into his attack against Paul. He says this in verse 4, but to detain you no further, I beg you in your kindness to hear us briefly. For we have found this man a plague, one who stirs up riots amongst all the Jews throughout the world and is a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. He even tried to profane the temple, but we seized him. By examining him yourself, you will be able to find out from him about everything of which we accuse him. Those are heavy words. When you consider what it means to be a Nazarene, when you consider just how poorly they were thought of, he says a lot of bad things about Paul, profaning the temple, he is stirring up the people, he's been a plague to our nation, he's the reason for all the problems. You are the reason for all of our health, wealth, and wisdom. This guy is the reason you're not succeeding as much as you'd like to. Let's put him down. He's the riffraff. These are harsh words. So how does Paul respond? Go over to verse 14. He says, but this I confess to you, that according to the way, which they call a sect, I worship the God of our fathers, believing everything laid down by the law and written in the prophets, having a hope in God, which these men themselves accept, that there will be a resurrection of both the just and the unjust. So I always take pains to have a clear conscience towards both God and man. He says, I'm not a sect of your beliefs. I am not a sect of anything. I am of the only true belief. The thing that you accept is actually a part of what I believe. He turns the tables on them. And so when he's faced with being called this lowly human being, he doesn't throw it off of himself. He doesn't say, no, I'm not associated with anyone from Nazareth. He says, those people that are associated from Nazareth, with the person from Nazareth, are not a sect of you. We are walking the way. We are walking the truth. Completely turns the tables. This continues with the phrase of Nazareth or Nazarene throughout the scriptures in Acts 22:8. Jesus himself, when he talks to Paul, says, I am Jesus of Nazareth. In Acts 3, verse 6, when Peter is healing a man, he says, in the name of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, stand up and walk. So instead of accepting Nazareth as a derogatory term, with all of the things that Jesus could be known by, think about this. I mean, Jesus Christ, King of Kings, Lord of Lords, once made man, resurrected God himself become man, Emmanuel, all the names that have been given to Christ, the Lion and the Lamb, the Lion of Judah, what he chooses to call himself is Jesus of Nazareth. He wears it proudly. That is not anything to be ashamed of in Jesus' mind. And Peter, when he heals this man, there's no distancing himself from one of the riffraff of Nazareth. He says, no, look what an amazing thing came out of Nazareth. I'm proud of that title. And this continued to gain recognition throughout the Bible. Today, people will literally do the exact same thing. They will belittle our faith because they'll say it's from some mystic preacher from a remote corner of the desert. They're trying to make you feel dumb about what you believe based on its location. But this is a logical fallacy. It's a red herring. It's an ad hominem attack. We don't have to be afraid of these attacks. Jesus and the apostles, they certainly don't seem to be. The reality is, Jesus was sent to Nazareth to fulfill a prophecy. And it was a prophecy that was going to be fulfilled in one of the most unlikely ways imaginable. The glory of God is going to come to Nazareth. He can grow in popularity and fame. He can do amazing works. He can draw a crowd because what he's saying is true and right and good. All from Nazareth, the place you would least expect him to be able to work from, the place with the least resources, the least attachment to the overall broader society. And so when you say that someone is a Nazarene, what you're saying is, no, I'm associated with Jesus of Nazareth, who came as God in the flesh to one of the most humble places in the world to change the fate of the world. That doesn't sound so bad. So go ahead, call us that if you'd like. I don't mind. That seems to be what the first century apostles thought as well. The next name I want to get to is seed picker. This one sounds a little weird. I bet you didn't know that Christians were called seed pickers before, but they were. Turn to Acts chapter 17. Honestly, seed picker doesn't even sound that bad. Like, it kind of lacks meaning. But at this time, it was used as an insult. Starting in verse 16 is where we'll begin reading. This is when Paul travels to Athens, and this is just prior to his address at the Areopagus. Acts 17:16. Now, while Paul was waiting for them at Athens, this was his other friends that were journeying with him, his spirit was provoked within him as he saw that the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the devout persons, and in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be there. Some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers also conversed with him, and some said, "What does this babbler wish to say?" Others said, "He seems to be a preacher of foreign divinities because he was preaching Jesus and the resurrection." This word, babbler, is spermologos, which means seed picker. That's the literal definition or the literal interpretation of what that word is. This was somebody who was a street preacher. They were spewing whatever doomsday prophecy they could possibly get a hold of. They were sharing every bit of new knowledge and forming it together into some weird ministry. Nobody was following them. They were on the side of the road just screaming obscenities and telling you that the world was going to end. That's a seed picker. But they were taking a truth from here, and a truth from here, and a truth from over there, and they were putting it into one cohesive message. So they were picking out the seeds of truth, just like a bird, and then presenting that as one belief. And that's what they say that Paul is doing. So what we can tell here is that they heard things that Paul was saying that rang true to them. Something about what he was preaching made some sort of sense, and yet it was confusing. They needed clarity on this. This is why they asked to see him again. If he had gone and preached nothing that they had ever heard before or nothing that they believed at all, I mean, we can see this at the Areopagus. Paul used their own context to preach to them, right? And so when he's speaking to these people, they say, yeah, you're getting like this piece from our beliefs, this piece from over here. You're a seed picker. You're not actually presenting a whole message. You're just stealing from everybody else. So in Acts 17, verse 24, if you want to roll down there with me, it says, "The God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything. Since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place, that they should seek God and perhaps feel their way toward him and find him. Yet he is not actually far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being, as even some of your own poets have said, for we are indeed his offspring." So Paul is saying, you say that you recognize some element of truth to what I'm saying. You say that I'm picking a truth from here and a truth from here and a truth from there from different belief systems. Instead, let me tell you about God the Father of all, where every ounce of truth comes from. I will show you that it was you who was picking and choosing what to believe and what not to believe, because I get my information from the source himself. Certainly, some of what you say is true. You have poets that spoke wisdom. You have an altar to an unknown God over here that seems to be pointing in the direction of something better than what you've got over here that you claim to know is God. So some of what you have makes sense, but you do not have all that you need. You're the seed picker. You just got one of them, one little seed of truth. Today, we will be accused of taking wisdom from other religions. This happens all the time. The golden rule, that's from every faith that ever existed. Confucius probably was the one that came up with that. The flood, that's just a universal myth story that everybody has. It's some catastrophe that happens. It doesn't mean it actually happened. It doesn't mean the Bible even had it right. They were stealing from other people. What about Savior back from the dead? Nimrod did that. Odin did that. Odin actually did it after 3 days on a tree. I don't know if you know that story, but Odin, the Norse god, died on a tree for 3 days and then came back to life. And they would say, you just stole that from the Odin myth. Why would we believe what you have to say? But we don't have to be shaken by this. Yes, other religions, even pagan ones, have gotten a few things right over the years. This makes sense if the biblical account of Genesis is actually historical, because we have a common origin. We all started at the same place. Their insult, seed picker, is an admission that there is truth to what's being said and that it's scattered everywhere. Our claim is that we found the source of it. We know who he is. Or rather, he found us. The next name I'd like to look at is disturbers of the peace. This one is interesting. It happens a lot in the New Testament. Several instances where we could draw from. The apostles preached Christ and were beaten for drawing a crowd. Elijah, even in the Old Testament, was labeled by Ahab as a troubler of Israel, one who disrupts the waters. But I'll continue on with Paul, because it definitely happens to him too. In Acts chapter 16, in verse 20, this is just another one of the myriad of accusations leveled against Paul and the other apostles. This one comes after Paul released a demon-possessed girl from possession, and it lost the money of the people that were exploiting her. So they had this slave girl that was possessed by a demon. Paul eventually freed her from that demon, and the people that were profiting off of the slave girl were furious because she couldn't do predictions or anything supernatural anymore. And so they get mad and they bring Paul to the authorities. Acts chapter 16, 20. And when they had brought them to the magistrates, they said, "These men are Jews, and they are disturbing our city. They advocate customs that are not lawful for us as Romans to accept or practice." The crowd joined in attacking them, and the magistrates tore the garments off them and gave orders to beat them with rods. And when they had inflicted many blows upon them, they threw them into prison, ordering the jailer to keep them safely. Having received this order, he put them into the inner prison and fastened their feet in the stocks. Now, peace is a good thing. It's hard to defend against being called a disturber of the peace because typically there's evidence for it. Things were quiet, now they're not. Something happened, you're the catalyst. It's just right there in front of you. So there was calm, now there's not. It's your fault. And it's actually hard to imagine that disturbing or breaking peace is a good thing, because peace itself is good, right? So how are we going to spin this in a good way? How could disturber of the peace ever be a positive? I believe this comes from a profound misunderstanding of what peace is, because often when we think about peace, we think about stillness. And there's nothing abjectly wrong about this. Peace, as we understand it, can be enhanced by calm. That is true. But peace and stillness are not the same thing. I'm going to do some rapid-fire verses here just to prove this point. Mark 4:39, Christ shouts into the storm, "Peace, be still." He's not saying, "Be still, be still." These are two things he's commanding of the storm. Proverbs 3:17, the Jews use this as a descriptor of what the entirety of the Torah is about. It says, "Her ways are pleasant and her paths are shalom," peace. Her paths are not still. They might be gentle, They might be free of conflict, they might be easy, but it's still a path. It requires action. It's something you have to do. In even the name of God is often peace. And so if we wanted to say that peace is stillness, we'd have to say, well, God is just kind of still. You know, he doesn't really do a lot. That's not true. God is constantly active. He's always doing things. He is still the God of peace. And yet it doesn't mean stillness or nothing or the absence of movement or effort or energy. Romans 12:18 says, as far as it depends on you, live at peace. Living is an action. It requires going forward. It requires wandering through this world and trying to find the best way forward. It can be difficult at times, but it says live at peace. It's a forward progress. In Isaiah 66, we're told that peace can look like a rushing river. Why not still waters? Well, it can be that too, but it just doesn't necessarily mean that it has to be something still. In 1 Corinthians 14:33, we're given a little bit clearer picture, I believe, of what peace actually is. Paul says that God is not a God of confusion or disorder, but of peace. So peace and order are closely related. Clarity could be another word. Surety, well-being, calm can still be a part of this, but it's not complete to say that peace is the same as stillness. And this is why it's not ironic when Paul also says in Romans 16:20, the God of peace will soon crush Satan under your feet. That doesn't sound peaceful when we think of it like, well, it's just kind of like pacifist and easygoing and still. No, that's not what peace is. It can be that, but it does not have to mean that in its entirety. So when Paul is called a disturber of the peace, let's look at how he responds to understand a little bit more about what peace is and how we can take this name upon ourselves just fine without any care in the world. Normally, I would not want to be a disturber of the peace, but how Paul does it here, I'm okay with this. In Acts chapter 16, verse 25, I'm not going to read it. I'm just going to go through the story, but you can follow along if you'd like. Because Paul responds in true peace to his circumstances. He's in jail, and he's singing, and he's praying. He's not clamoring or fighting or reviling or attempting to escape. Instead, he's assuring a man that he doesn't needlessly need to kill himself. He's sharing the good news of the truth with the jailer. This is orderly. This is right. This is working towards well-being. This is an effort towards peace. But he also, later in the story, demands that the magistrates come and apologize to him and Silas for their wrongful treatment, which is hilarious. At that time, so the magistrates beat him, put him in prison, find out he's a Roman citizen, say, "Ooh, now we want peace." Paul says, "No. We're not going to have that kind of peace. You're going to get off your butt and come here and apologize to us. That's what's going to happen here." He further disturbs their peace because their peace is just quiet injustice. They're using the wrong definition of peace. It does not mean that no conflict is happening or that nothing is going on that's unsettling or against the status quo. Everything Paul did was against the status quo. In this, though, Paul is still being orderly and just and right and working towards well-being. He's refusing that the injustice be allowed to stand. And in that, he's actually promoting peace. When the peace of the world is injustice and evil, then disturbing that peace, not with warfare or antagonism or rage, but disturbing that peace in an attempt to promote true peace, then being called a disturber of the peace isn't so bad. When you realize that their definition is off and that you have access to true and lasting peace, a peace that the Bible says transcends even our own understanding, then sharing it might make them mad, but it also completely disarms them. Look at how humbled the magistrates were in this section. As soon as Paul disturbs their peace and refuses to go quietly, they come humbly to him. They still want to get this done as quietly as possible. They can't rage against him, no matter how much they want to. And so we might be called all kinds of things that hurt because they make it seem like we're against good things. But that's not always true. If you're called stupid, that doesn't feel good because we desire knowledge and understanding. If we're called evil, it doesn't feel good because we desire goodness. If we're called heartless, It doesn't feel good because we desire compassion. But if we realize that often the people who call us stupid don't have the understanding we have, it doesn't really feel as bad. When we realize the people that call us evil don't even understand foundational truths of what good is, their insult is meaningless at that point. And when we realize they're mistaking compassion for pity and tolerance, it's probably okay being called these things. We need to respond with truer versions of these things. They wanted peace. Paul responded with true peace. And to them, that looked like something that was against them because they weren't practicing true peace. We can share truth. We can overcome evil with good. We can have genuine compassion that doesn't want to see people harm themselves with their own ideologies. If the world's peace is war with Christ, then I will gladly disturb it. That's fine with me. You can call me a disturber of the peace. Call me what you'd like. The last one I'd like to look at is the term Christian. Now, this one's interesting because that's what we call ourselves. However, this was not always the case. Christians were not always known as Christians. And this is probably the best example of Christians being slandered and then leaning into the punch because we've adopted it and it's lasted even today. Turn with me to Acts chapter 11. Acts chapter 11, verse 25. It says this, "So Barnabas went to Tarsus to look for Saul. They had heard that there were people in Antioch thriving after the death of Stephen." So Stephen dies, the people are scattered, and they hear, man, the Christians at Antioch, well, they're not called Christians, the believers at Antioch are doing really well. We need to go check it out. So Barnabas goes and gets Paul, or Saul at this point, and it says he brought him to Antioch, and for a whole year they met with the church and taught a great many people, and in Antioch the disciples were first called Christians. Now, historically, the people of Antioch have a long history of satirical name-calling. It's a common method in Greek thinking to make you appear as the other. When I give you a name, even if it's not that insulting, it's just poking fun generally, I've labeled you. I have set you over here. I've boxed you in. So you're right here, and I can either dismiss you or open you up, take you off the shelf anytime I want, but it's meant to just set you apart, make you other than we are. At this time, if you were loyal to the general Pompey, you were a Pompeian. That's what they would call you. And that doesn't sound that funny to us, right? Like, that kind of makes sense. If you're for Pompey, you're a Pompeian. If we're from Ohio, we're Ohioans. You know, we've actually adopted this. But we've just refused to take it as an insult. But at this time, to say you're a Pompeian from someone who wasn't for Pompey, that would have been an insult. Same thing with Augustus, you're an Augustinian. So in the first century, this is just fun wordplay to poke fun at people. That they're following a certain person or idea or group. And so when members of the way came to Antioch following the death of Stephen, they heard that they were worshiping this Christ, or this Christos, as their head. And so they became Christian, meaning little Christs. That's what they called them. That does sound demeaning. And yet, the people at Antioch heard that and they said, I'm supposed to be like that. I'm supposed to be like Christ. I'm supposed to reflect him into this world. And so they took it proudly. And so what the Antiochians, whatever the people from Antioch are called, we can call them that now because it's not insulting anymore, right? Whatever the people of Antioch were called, they're trying to say, oh yeah, these little Christs over here. And the Christians are saying, I love it. Let's keep that going. I think that's hilarious. Interestingly, some of our earliest external sources that are written about Christians and Christ, there's a lot of misspellings. And so often, instead of Christos, it was written Krestos with an E. Or instead of Christiani, it was Christiani with an E. What's funny about this is Krestos actually means good or useful or valuable. And so every time they made fun of them with this, they were actually calling them good, valuable, even when they messed up the name. And so Christians accepted this too, and that's why you see that in a lot of early writings. This reminds me of the show Parks and Rec. There's this hilarious time where this cult group wants to rent out the park. And they're signing out the form. They say, oh yeah, we call ourselves the Reasonableists, because then if anybody's against us, it seems like they're against people being reasonable. That's genius. If you call me a little Christ, or you call me a little good one, or a little valuable one, that's not an insult at all. And yet it was meant as one. So sometimes people out of ignorance will try and belittle you by their low estimation of what you do or who you follow. No offense needs to be taken here. I do follow Jesus Christ. I actually couldn't think of a better name you could call me. That's a compliment to me. Now, they might say it in derision, but we can wear it proudly because it's true. We don't need to be afraid of labels, because even if it's spoken out of misunderstanding or derision, it can still speak good things about us to other people. In 200 AD, a Roman came in contact with a Christian in Rome. He heard about his faith, and he thought it was the most ridiculous thing he'd ever heard. A dying God? A criminal? Worshiping a person who isn't alive anymore? Who was found guilty and died in humiliation? How stupid could you be? And so, with nothing better to do, he carved on the wall of the Roman town little stick figures, and he labeled it what it was. So what this picture is there's one man standing on the ground with his arm raised up, and he's looking into the eyes of another person who has the head of a donkey. And the person that has the head of a donkey is hanging on a cross. And the description says, Alexamenos sabete theon. Alexamenos worships his God. Nothing said here is false. It's not slander, but it's certainly meant that way. But on another wall, a nameless person, having seen the graffiti, carved his own response in addition. He wrote, Alexamenos fidelis. Alexamenos is faithful. Jesus and the apostles throughout the New Testament told us that scoffers are going to come. People are going to revile us. They will speak all kinds of evil against us. They've been there all along. Why shouldn't they be there now? These people will have misunderstandings about what we believe, or they'll understand it perfectly and hate it. They'll hear us and mock us, or they'll mock us without hearing us. They might call us names and attack our beliefs. They might dismiss the beliefs and us as stupid, heretical, evil, disruptive. So who knows what awful things we might be called in the future. Matthew 5:11 says, "Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven. For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you." Now the word falsely here is actually not in all manuscripts. I think that's really interesting. Speak evil against you falsely. I think it's interesting because it's actually appropriate. Sometimes they will speak evil against us falsely. They'll just outright lie. And sometimes they'll speak evil against us, and it's true. I am a Christian. I don't care if you say it in derision. That's what I am. However, the most important thing is that no matter what you're called, whether it's a lie or not, whatever it is they write on the wall against you or against God, that you endure it patiently so that others, and especially God, can carve their own commentary on the wall as well, so that no matter what else they call you, you're also called faithful.